Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome once again to Progressive News Network. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak, and I have a special pleasure tonight. You know, we do politics every week, and it brings everybody the news they need and news they're not hearing anywhere else, and that's a wonderful thing. But, you know, every so often I just need to clean my palate and talk with people who change the world in a whole different way. Think of the artists, whether it be a choreographer, a painter, or a cartoonist, or a jazz musician, as someone who builds a better world because of the art that they make, because of the way they inspire others. I've been fortunate in my life. Music has been a huge part of my life, and I've been honored by knowing many, many just wonderful musicians. I have brought you two extraordinary players tonight. These two gentlemen, and I'm talking about Dan Bonsanti and Joe Donato, are two people who I tell you will light your life up with the music that they make, the music they write, the music they perform. And I can tell you it is nothing but pure pleasure what we're going to have for your ears tonight. And let me welcome, my friends, a talented composer, arranger, and performer, orchestra leader of Orchestra 14, Maestro Dan Bonsanti. Maestro, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Rick.
How you doing, Dan? How you been?
I'm doing well, thank you. Very well. Thank you so much for your invitation to be part of your show this evening. I appreciate it.
Well, Dan, as you know, this is a show where we typically invite progressive activists to talk about the ways they work to make this a better world. And by my lights, you, sir, are a person who's making this a better world simply by the music that you make.
Oh, thank you.
I
hope that's the case.
Well, I can assure you, as a person with ears trained to listen to quality music, my friend, you commit quality music every time you get on a stand.
Thank you very much.
Well, Dan, let's talk about your early years. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in a small town in New Jersey. I was born in New York, but I grew up in New Jersey and lived in a town called Dumont, and came here to South Florida to go to the University of Miami in 1968, and I've been a resident of the Miami area for all except for two of those years since 1968.
Well, Florida's a richer place for it. I'm going to take you back to Jersey just for a minute, and I want to ask you a couple of questions about your young life.
Sure.
When did you first pick up an instrument?
Well, I started actually playing when I was about 6 years old, started on the clarinet in elementary school. They had a program for music. Little classes to start kids on instruments, and played clarinet in elementary school. And then switched to saxophone when I got to middle school, and then expanded to other woodwinds when I got to high school.
Great. Let me ask you this. When you were, just a young guy, playing your clarinet and swapping to sax in middle school, a lot of bands up north, and I suppose some down here as well, in their music department, sometimes they had little ensembles, whether it was a dance band or a pickup band or a pep band that played the basketball or the football games. Were you involved in that kind of band music as well?
Yes, in middle school is when they in Dumont they started a concert band and played in that for a couple of years, and then when we got to high school, they had the typical marching band, a concert band, and we had what they used to call a stage band, a big band, typical instrumentation for a big band. So I had those three different kinds of ensembles the 4 years that I was in high school. Plus, we formed our own garage band, and I had another kind of an instrumental, kind of a jazz ensemble also that the students just put together.
Well, I had the good fortune of starting young myself, and I count those many years just of such a powerful and happy influence on my life. Was there a time, when did you know, or was there a moment in your young life when you said, I'm a musician, this is what I'm going to do?
Yeah, I started to feel that way in the middle of my high school years, sometime around sophomore or junior year, I got much more serious about it, started to take, you know, private lessons in a more intense fashion. I had the good fortune of having my brother, my older brother, Neil, who was an outstanding musician, and that was an inspiration, hearing him play around the house, and he helped me quite a bit during my high school years. And then I had the great, you know, fortune of having fabulous teachers at the University of Miami.
Now, is Neil also a broad woodwind player as well?
Absolutely, phenomenal, really exceptional studio players. Had a year as many years in music education as well. Plays all the woodwind instruments, the double reed instruments, oboe, English horn, flute, piccolo, clarinet, bass clarinet, all the saxophones. Really a multi-talented woodwind player, yes.
I've heard had the pleasure of hearing him many times with Atlantean Driftwood and Peter Graves' band. Just fantastic stuff. Let me ask you again.
He plays with us. He plays, of course, in our 14 Jazz Orchestra group, too. So it's great to be able to work with your own brother in that context. It's fantastic.
That's wonderful. Let me ask you this. You know, there's some shifts kind of in mental approach when you shift from being just a player and, you know, you're picking the music you like and that, and that change to where you start thinking about arranging, you start thinking about composing. When did you begin to arrange and compose?
Well, pretty late in my career, actually. I started being interested in it during the years that I worked up in the Sunrise Music Theater in the early 1980s. I started to write some of the first arrangements in the late 70s and then began to write for the Atlantean Driftwood Band retained that interest. I had the good fortune of working with players like Gary Lindsay in those bands, who was an outstanding writer, and if I had questions, I had someone I could go to. And I also had the great opportunity to play great music, which was a real help in understanding quality orchestration and all other aspects, technical aspects as well, of composing and arranging. And, of course, then I had all the years that I got to teach with Ron Miller and absorb some of his incredible writing.
I know when I was just a youngster, my school typically started you in third or fourth grade. They tried to push you toward fourth, and I convinced them in second grade that I needed to play trumpet. So that was when I got the bug, and very profoundly instrumental in that drive in me was I saw two biopics. Of course, they weren't that true to nature, but they really caught my imagination. I saw the biopic about George Gershwin's life, and also the biopic called Young Man with a Horn about Bix Beiderbecke, which really didn't include much of Bix's music, but it was a total profound story, and it really touched me. What composers touched you when you were young? What composers really caught your ear and heart?
Well, I would say it was more players initially, actually, Rick,
yeah?
Because my initial interest wasn't so much in writing. As I said, that came later. We had recordings around the house. My brother had a collection of albums where I first started to be exposed to Charlie Parker and Cannonball Adderley and many other bebop saxophone players. And then as time went on, of course, I became enamored with Coltrane's music, Wayne Shorter, Sonny Rollins, and all of the masters of the saxophone. And I spent quite a bit of time listening to those players in my late during high school, and then, of course, extensively once I came to college.
So, what led you to UM? Was it the reputation or the players?
It's a combination of things. First of all, my brother had gone to school there, and I knew that the community offered a lot of professional opportunities. And then I had heard upon several occasions about Jerry Coker, who was considered even in those days to be one of the premier jazz educators in the United States, and that the U of M had in those days a brand new jazz program. And so I also had a modest interest in science, marine sciences, and it seemed like a perfect place to go where I'd have exposure to both of those things. And, of course, once I got here and was 100% involved in music, I no longer thought of marine biology as an option. But initially when I was looking at the school, I knew that their reputation in both of those areas was excellent.
Well, Dan, I think we've talked long enough. It's about time we dip into that some of that wonderful repertoire you sent us. Now we've got the used to be cha-cha or remark you made. What would you like to hear first, or what do you want to talk about first?
Well, I think maybe playing one of the recordings that I did with Atlantean and Driftwood Band that I had a chance to play with for almost 20 years. And in the
wow.
early years, that included, of course, Jaco Pastores before Jaco went on his own. It was Peter Graves' orchestra when we played commercially. And then Peter was the originator of the band and conducted and led the band for all those years. Jaco played bass with us in the very early years. Pat Metheny played with us. We had great musicians in that band. It was a fabulous experience. And in the later years of Atlantean Driftwood, I did a variety of different arrangements, one which I think I sent you that's called Oops. And
yep,
that was originally written for a jazz festival where Michael Brecker was going to be a guest with us. And so that particular arrangement was written for that festival, and we later recorded that sometime in around 87 or 88. I think I'm at least close. I can't remember the exact year.
Sure, sure. So this is Peter's band?
This is the Atlantean Driftwood Band, led by Peter Graves, and was among the first arrangements that I did for the band.
Oh, great. Okay, here we go. Oops. What a great tune, man. What a great tune. I gotta tell you, the bop influence in that sax break is very, very telling. And the other thing I got to say is, you know, I don't think I've ever heard Peter's band in a situation where the arrangement didn't really show off the stellar performers and how the horn breaks and the sax section just really works so well to complement, not to mention the really great rhythms involved. And sort of that little tropical influence there in the middle of that one other break.
Mm-hmm.
Who carried that sax lead there?
Well, the solo was mine, the tenor solo. And
oh, nice.
Again, originally, though, it wasn't written for me. I wrote it for Michael Brecker to play with us at one of the jazz festivals out in the Fort Myers area, the Sanibel Jazz Festival, that Atlantic Driftwood was kind of the host band for that for, oh my goodness, it was more than 15 years, maybe almost 20 years every October.
I remember several of those that were just great.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to also ask you, the name, Oops, was that a part of the original thinking or was that an afterthought?
Well, that's not my composition. That's my my arrangement.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and Michael had recorded that tune in a small group setting on an album called The Hearts and Numbers, Steps Ahead. And so we were trying to put together some music that was things that Michael had recorded, and this was why that particular arrangement was completed and that tune selected. Of course, Michael didn't record that with us, but we looked forward that whole year knowing that he was going to be playing with us at that festival.
Well, you know, it must be a real extra thrill. I mean, to compose or arrange for a band like that, you had so many palette tools there with that sax section.
Great musicians, and you know, the key for successful arranging is for you to be able to write for the musicians that you know their strengths, the styles, what they enjoy playing. And being in the same band with basically the same players for so many years was a great advantage. You know, Peter liked to feature a lot of fusion music. We played some straight-ahead things, but we played a lot of fusion music with a variety of different kinds of influences. And, of course, we played a lot of Jaco's music and Larry Warlow's arrangements in that particular band. And Jaco's style and influence also rolled into the University of Miami program. He taught for about a semester or so in our program in the 1970s. And so the band, the University of Miami Concert Jazz Band at that time, also played some of his music. And Whit Seidner was the conductor in those days of the UMCJB. And Whit was kind enough also to play some of my own arrangements. And another arrangement that I had done originally for the Driftwood Band that I think I sent you but was recorded by the University of Miami Band was one of my own personal favorites. It was recorded with Weather Report. Jaco recorded the bass part, and that was a remark you made. And that was one of my favorite tunes. I arranged that, but Jaco never got to play it with us. He was killed before we had a chance to play it. But we recorded it with the U of M band and the current band called the Jaco Pastorius Big Band under the direction of Peter Graves has played that for many years. So that's a particular arrangement or a particular tune that I really love.
Well, let's play that one, a remark that you made. Beautiful.
Thanks,
absolutely
Rick.
Beautiful. Hey, I got to ask you a handful of questions. Question number one, sax break?
The sax player, that solo was, let's see, Peter Gallio, a student at the U of M at that particular time. And the keyboard part,
that was one of the Orta brothers.
Yeah, Mike Orta on the keyboard.
No kidding.
And then his brother Nick, I believe, was playing bass, did the bass part.
Yeah. I was wondering, because I know that Randy Burnson sometimes played with the band, and I was wondering, was that one of his extraordinary guitar patches? But, okay, that's great. It's almost kind of a Peruvian flute sort of feel.
I'm sorry, say that again, please?
I said it reminded me in a way of a Peruvian flute in certain places.
Well, you know, that was a lot of those particular sounds. I was trying to emulate what Zawinul did with Weather Report. He had the most outstanding different patches and combinations of sounds that he used on the synthesizer, and then trying to take those sounds and recreate them in a sense with acoustic instruments was a very fun challenge. Zawinul was always one of my favorite composers, and that particular tune, of course, since it was Jaco that was featured on the original recording, it became a favorite of mine. So that's how we came to put it together for the band.
Yeah, a bit of a melancholy tune.
Yes, very much so. I think it has a very fitting title, a remark you made.
Well, you can read a lot into that.
Yes, you can.
Okay. All right. You know, one of the other things I want to ask you, and I like to ask my musician friends this, you know, there's the music you listen to professionally. There's the music you listen to kind of get you to a certain mental space. And then there's the stuff you listen to for fun. What do you like to listen to for fun?
Oh, my goodness. For me personally, there isn't much of a difference. Almost all the listening I do is for the purpose of, you know, searching out interesting tunes. Sometimes those are tunes that I'm looking to see if I might want to use for my new band for the 14 Jazz Orchestra. And I'm doing a lot of that kind of listening. And so I have, usually I'll take 10, 11, 12, maybe up to 20 different things and listen to them over and over and over and see if I get tired of them. And if I find that I don't get tired of those compositions, that there might be things then that an audience would respond to, and that if I believe I can put together an orchestration, an arrangement of a piece like that, that the band would enjoy playing, that's usually how I select things. And that's the kind of listening I do. I would say that I do much more of that than I do listening necessarily just for relaxation. I'm a hunter. I do listening
well,
for hunting.
I hear you. That is just the kind of erudite answer I would expect from a master musician. But let me. I'm not going to let you get away quite that easily. When I go to bed, and if I've had a trying day, I'm going to listen to Strauss. Strauss is my medicine. He's my let my heart's ease go and just restore my spirit. What do you listen to before you go to bed last night? Can you put your finger on that?
I probably didn't listen to any music before I went to bed last night in particular, but generally speaking, I have a lot of different kinds of music on my iPhone, and I just select something that seems to be the right mood. Sometimes it just depends on how exhausted I am, or if I'm interested in something energetic. And then with satellite radio and the other apps that you have on your phone, that I have on my phone, it's not hard to find a channel to listen to where you can pick up either the same style of music if you want, like the Coltrane channel or something where you could listen to all of that kind of music, or or just satellite radio or something where you can just listen to one tune after another.
I'm not going to let you get off that easy. Well, take a look at your phone. What's the last thing you called up? What was your last listen channel?
Okay, well, let's see. The last thing that I listened to.
I told you this was going to be a rigorous interview.
Yeah, last thing I pulled up on my phone was my own playlist. And my own playlist consists of quite a versatile group. But the last thing I listened to was actually a Latin tune called Malambo. And it's recorded by the Wayne Wallace Latin Jazz Quintet. And that was the last thing that I listened to. And, you know, I've got quite an interesting assortment. I've got contemporary new arrangement that I've been listening to that Ravi Coltrane made around midnight. So it's pretty eclectic.
Yeah, I have 25 channels I listen to on Pandora. But I would say that a lot of what I like to listen to is straight ahead jazz, and I have a strong desire for political and folk music, that sort of thing. I like that. But I want to share one thing with you that I think you might just get a chuckle out of. I was such a committed Dixieland and improvisational jazz guy that when I was in high school, I had a garage band, and we did nothing but straight ahead New Orleans.
Wow. That must have been fun.
But of course,
that must have been a lot of fun.
Well, it was a blast. But my contemporaries who were listening to everything from Jimi Hendrix and Rolling Stones to the Beatles were going, "You're doing what?"
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that might have been a conflict.
Yeah, there weren't a lot of gigs for that.
No, and still not, unfortunately.
Well, you know, I turn to Bix a lot music that picks me up, and I really like, you know, syncopated rhythms, and that was one of the things I always enjoyed so much about Atlantean Driftwood and its different iterations, because they played sophisticated rhythms, and while I'm not a huge fusion fan, the instrumentation was so good, you know, you just had to enjoy it because the players were so good, the voicings were so marvelous. Let me ask you about your band today, 14 Orchestra. Can tell us about some of the players in that.
Oh, my goodness. Well, honestly, one of the great gifts working with this band is the outstanding studio and jazz players that we have. You know, the instrumentation is there's myself and 13 horns. It's the same basic instrumentation we used with Driftwood, and we've got outstanding players, the soloists. Well, everybody is a capable soloist, but I would say we tend to feature Ed Callier on saxophone, Ed Mena as one of them. And the saxophones also include my brother Neil and Randy Emmerich, who you've had on your show.
Oh, yeah.
That's also an outstanding jazz and studio player. Dante Luciani is our trombone soloist. We have Steve Reed has been playing lead trumpet with us. Most recently, Cisco Dimas, also one of the our trumpet players, Matt Benelli on bass, Jim Gazier on piano, and I know I'm missing a couple of the guys, Major Bailey on bass trombone. So I'm gonna get shot for missing a couple of the guys in the band, but they're just completely outstanding players and so much fun to write for, and sometimes I have to be careful not to get lost listening to their solos when my job is to do some conducting. So we started as a rehearsal band last summer. We were just looking to I was looking to do some more writing, and unfortunately, you know, there's not a lot of opportunities for larger ensembles in our community places to play. So we were going to get together and just do some fun, you know, rehearsing, and as the summer went on, after taking a summer break, the guys said, look, why don't we see if we can find some places to play? And so beginning in the fall, we did 3 or 4 local concerts. It's very difficult during the season year for those players to be able to get away from their professional commitments. So we don't do very much from January, really, through June. We'll probably start up. We're supposed to be doing some recording, hopefully sometime later this month, put together maybe our first CD. And then we've got some things booked for the fall. So I think we'll be lucky to be able to do 5 or 6 concerts a year. But the players are just, you know, they're just outstanding. So I'm really proud to be associated with them.
Well, I hope you'll keep us informed, especially if you're planning in the Palm Beach area, because we have a lot of listeners in that area and of course, across the state. But please keep us informed. And let me ask you to pick one from the 14 Orchestra. Do you have one of the cuts from the 14 Orchestra or just another one of your favorites?
The MP3s I sent you did not include that. All of our latest stuff is live, and it's on our website, which is 14jazzorchestra.com. So our listeners could go to that website and listen to quite a variety of live recordings.
Okay, well, there's links on the AveryVoice.com site to 14 Orchestra. How about just pick another one of your favorites up here?
Well, why don't we do something? Why don't we use one of the ones from the Jaco Pastorius Big Band? Did I send you Blackbird?
You did. You did indeed.
You might like to use that, play that for your audience. That features at the very end. There's a kind of a tag at the end of the arrangement. Jaco used to play Blackbird as a solo piece, just all on electric bass. And
incredible.
What you're about to hear is really his influence, and you'll hear this tag at the end that features Arturo Sandoval on trumpet.
I had the good fortune in my years at Pace to stage him at Gussman Hall.
Mm.
And I played that concert
that you did the sound on.
Oh,
that's the one,
man.
I'm thinking of.
Unbelievable, yeah. And the Peter's Atlanta Drifter was just in top form, and he came wandering through the house when wireless was brand new, and he was just breathtaking, as was the band. And it's one of the fond memories I have of working with a large ensemble like that. And I thank you, my friend, for this wonderful music you've made. And we may have time to just talk about it a little bit afterwards. Thank you so much, Dan. And
oh,
here,
man,
we go.
Thank you for your invitation.
Oh, you bet. Blackbird from, I gather, the Word of Mouth series. Here we go. astounding. Absolutely astounding.
That hurt my ears.
Well, who got
incidentally,
that phenomenal...
that's Peter Erskine on drums and Richard Bona on the bass part and Ed Callier on soprano saxophone.
And that trumpet break at the end?
That was Arturo Sandoval.
Wow. What an amazing... You know, it was telling such a good story musically that you almost forget till the end that there's a big band behind this thing. And then the band tears out and you go, oh, that's right, my God.
Well, Arturo lets you know for sure that it's a big band screaming on the top of it, sure.
Dan, thank you so very much, my friend. And I wish you every success.
Pleasure. Thank you so much. And I know your audience is going to be thrilled to hear from Joe Donato, my old friend. We went to school together and I've had so much personal and professional time over the last 44 years. So I love Joe like a brother. So you guys will have a great time.
I'm sure we will. And he spoke so highly of you as well, my friend. So Maestro,
what tune
should we go out on, sir?
Used to be a cha-cha is the Jaco Pastorius Big Band, and that is Jaco's own composition. And so hopefully the audience like that. It's got obviously a Latin flavor to it. So,
well, thanks again, Dan. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks a lot, Rick.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Gentlemen, I have the great pleasure to bring on another incredible genius of music and performance, Maestro Joe Donato. Welcome, Maestro.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks. Thank you.
Sir, it is such a great pleasure to have you on the show. Your friend, Maestro Bonsanti, said some wonderful things about you, and I told him you said some
listening.
Wonderful things about
great.
Him.
Yeah, Rick, I heard it all. Rick, I enjoyed your show so much. I can't tell you the last time I actually listened to radio. I mean, I think the Lone Ranger was the show, you know, or the Shadow, you know. I mean, when I say listen to the radio, I don't mean like I'm trapped in a car, you know, and I put the radio on so that I don't have to deal with the ridiculous drivers. I'm saying I put the show on when you made your comments about the soldier, you know, in the news today, and that was very beautiful, and I totally agree with you. Where is the compassion? Everywhere, you know, it's missing. That's what we need more than ever, you know, to start, just for starts. You know, I'm talking, Rick, about what you said in the beginning about the soldier. Then after that, I listened to the other interview you did. This has been wonderful. I'm actually sitting here just listening to radio. So I'm your first-time listener, and I'm going to be your I've always been your fan.
Now
I'm going to be a fan of the radio show.
Well,
and
it's mutual admiration.
Rick,
sir.
And one more comment about the Dan Bonsanti, and that music was just absolutely amazing. And
it was
just so grand and elegant. And he is something else. He's a dear friend, but one of the brightest people and finest artists that I've ever known. And his music is there to be heard. And you got to hear this new band he's got. One of the best on the planet.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, Maestro Donato, let's talk about your wonderful career so far And one of the first questions I want to ask you, sir, is when did you first pick up an instrument? When did you first say, I got to do that? That's amazing.
Oh, yeah, 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 sure. I remember. I remember it well. You know, I always loved the music so much. I loved listening to it, and I wanted to be part of it. I remember early in my... You remember when cars used to have big, fat, white walls?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I think they're back again now, you know. but in the 40s, you know, I was born in the early 40s. In the 40s and even in the 50s, the big, fat, white walls. And my father would make me get out there and, you know, make them wash them white walls, you know, with cleanser and the brush.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the way I would express the music, getting there, doing a job, but having, and if you know what, I still find anything I'm working around, I've got a rhythm going, I've got a beat going, depending on the type of job, you know, it's doing, like a lot of times it's march music to keep me going, you know, to keep me in the job, keep working,
sure.
Whatever. And by the way, you mentioned the Strauss. Was it Johann Strauss or Richard Strauss that you were one of your favorites?
Johann.
Oh, the Waltz King.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Those are the first tunes I ever learned to play on my trumpet. I learned the Strauss, the Blue Danube Waltz, and it, man, it rings my bell to this day. I sit back, got another waltz for artists and musicians. I think it is just phenomenal stuff. I mean, it just eases the heart in these exciting times.
Yeah.
So were you in elementary school when you first started playing?
Well, actually, my mother said you can start the music lesson as soon as you learn the alphabet, at least up to G, you know. I was 5 years old when I started, and that's when they allowed me to begin my music studies. So, what are we going to have? What are we going to do? What are you going to play? Well, I want to play the accordion. That's the Italian word for accordion. The accordion.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so I want to play the accordion. Why? Because everybody else is playing it. I want to do what everybody else is doing. I play the accordion.
Sure.
No. We have a friend who's getting out of the Army. He doesn't have anybody to teach. He plays saxophone. You're going to play the sax.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, what's a sax? And you'll find out. See, in my family, Rick, you didn't ask questions about, I don't think I care for that, or maybe I'd like to. No. There was none of that. Here's what you're going to do. This is it, and that's the end of the story, period. So we started on saxophone lessons. I wasn't a very good student then. In fact, I was more interested in tricking the teacher. You see, as soon as I found out he didn't really know, you know, exactly what was happening, you know, with the music, then I just started improvising everything. And we went through, I mean, books, virtuoso books. I couldn't read a note of it, but I would look at it and then decide, you know, what it looked like, and then just start playing. And, boy, this kid's great, you know. Wow, he just... Because he wasn't reading the thing, and neither was I, and that's the way we went on for many years. But the good part was the lessons were only 50 cents a lesson, so at least it wasn't too expensive. And that's it. And so I had a lot of experience improvising, and then I continued that and started, you know, putting that to use. I started my band, my first band, which was called Little Joe and the Juveniles. And because at that time, juvenile delinquents was a popular word.
Sure, sure.
So Little Joe and the Juveniles, you know, and that was my first band. And
was this high school or middle school?
No, we're still like 8, 9, 10 years old.
No,
gigs, you know, in my hometown. Yes, indeed. Well, you see, I found a way to get out of the, you know, the strictness of the family that I've alluded to, you know, in my family.
Yeah.
It's a very strict situation there, you know. Maybe mother's
sure.
a little more lenient, but dad, well, he was in the army in Germany, you know, for fighting the Nazi movement there, and when he didn't see me, I was almost 3 years old. So when he got home from the service, you know, I became one of his soldiers, and it was very much a military. So the only way I could get out of that was to, you know, really blow that horn. And that's what got me out of the house and got me
added
playing.
Motivation.
There you go. There you go. And you know, playing all the time, performing. And and then I always wanted to sort of get back to really learning my instrument, you know what I mean, and studying formally. And that took a while because you get very busy with the doing of it, you know, playing the music and performing. And so you get to be kind of natural at that and have a, you know, an ease with doing it, and many opportunities to do it, you know, when you're doing it all the time. So I put off the studies, but in fact, I was about 15 years old when I had an offer from one of the bands to go on the road, and I said, but don't call my house because, you know, my father will be playing on the phone, and then when he hangs up, bada-boom, I'm going to get it for putting you up to this, you know, or allowing this to, don't call. So they called, and here's the amazing thing. He says, all right, I'll let you take him on the road. So he signed me out of school. Well, I wasn't doing that good in school anyway because I was busy. I was busy entertaining everybody during the class. So Pop let me go. 15 years old, I was loose on the world here, you know, on the road playing with bands. And
so was this pop music?
Oh yes, yes indeed, yes, absolutely pop music. I always had a feel for the rhythm of jazz and the rhythm and blues, you know, and a good groove. So that was always present for the musicality. But the material was basically pop music and what was happening, cover tunes and all that. And so I got to do some traveling and playing around, and finally, back of my mind, I always had it. Yeah, but you know, you don't even have a high school diploma, and you don't even that balance. You want to be legitimate, you know, instead of just making it, you know, out there. So, I got my GED, and then next thing you know, I sat in with a band in Texas. I was playing in Houston, Texas. I sat in with a band. He says, "Wow, boy, you ought to come to the Baptist College. We could use you. In fact, we could give you a scholarship, you know." So, you I just got my GED. Now I'm going to be in college. So I'm very excited about that. So I made it to the school and played with them. And it just so happened that the dean of University of Miami came to that school to give us accreditation. In other words, we were not accredited college. Right now, it's a grand university. I mean, one of the biggest in all of Houston, called Houston Baptist College. But at that time, it was just a small college, unaccredited. So Dean Bill Lee came there to check us out and see if we were, you know, had all the necessary credits, you know, or what the standards, you know, to be an accredited college.
Yeah.
And that's when he heard me play. So he invited me to come to Miami and be the lead saxophonist with the University of Miami, the number one jazz band.
Let me stop you just there for a second,
because
probably there are people out there that don't know what a tremendous influence Dean Bill Lee had on the UM music program.
My goodness, yes. He's the one who went out scouting around for talent and brought Pat Metheny here. And, well, he brought me here, and I'm eternally grateful for what he did. And, I went through undergraduate work here and completed the work I started in Houston. And then some years later, I went into graduate work and then completed a master's degree. And but all at the same time, always performing.
Joe,
you know.
In fact, let me ask you about that, because this was this the early 60s or late 50s when you came to UM?
No, I arrived here on, I played my New Year's gig in Houston, Texas, the year was coming in 1970.
1970,
and I was there
okay.
with, I took Edgar Winter's place in his band, and the guitarist was Randall Delahan, who, I don't know if you were familiar with
sure,
Randall.
Sure, sure.
He had 35 years as the head of the jazz guitar here. What happened was, I'm from Texas, I came here, and then thanks to Bill Lee. You asked me when did I arrive?
Yeah.
It was right after New Year's Eve. We drove here, my wife and I. We drove here with all our belongings, and got started. I asked the deans. It was cold that year too. It was cold. I said, well, this is Miami. I'm freezing over here. I had a coat on, I asked the dean's secretary, Mrs. Ely. I said, Mrs. Ely, we just arrived here. I don't know where to go and live. Well, she says, one place you don't want to live is that Coconut Grove. It's full of hippies, and they got artists everywhere. Okay, thank you, ma'am. And next thing you know, zoom, right to the Grove. And I loved it, and I lived there for many years, and then sort of from there moved out to the country, and finally ended up in the edge of the Everglades. That was the last move we made.
Well, there was a tremendous music scene in Miami and Miami Beach back then, wasn't there?
In 1970, yes, indeed. Well, that's when Peter Graves had his the Driftwood Band, and I was with a very interesting and special orchestra called the Baker's Dozen. I don't know if you're familiar with that band.
No, that didn't ring a bell.
Well, that was composed of 13 of the, best players in town at the time, and it was conducted by Vince Maggio, played piano, and also did much of the arranging. And that was a very special group at the time, and it was my pleasure playing with them at the same time having my own pop group, to make a living.
Well, I was going to say, with your dynamic personality, I can't imagine you sitting in a section for very long. I would imagine you'd be moving toward the front of that stage pretty darn quick.
Well, Rick, I'll tell you, it was a difficult seat to sit in because I wasn't trained, like many of my colleagues, to do that music properly, and all the doubles that are involved. There's clarinet and flute, and you have to be a great reader, and there's many other things. But going to the University of Miami, they got me right away. I mean, they put me up to speed. I mean, so I wasn't afraid to go and play a circus, which is some of the hardest music to go and do, because you're constantly moving and playing everything, and there's no introspection there. It's all, moving right along, and doubles are galore. But then after that, I just sort of went back to the same thing I've done, before. I learned those skills, which is playing and entertaining in the pop music field. Yeah, I've played with some big bands since then, with the Jerry Fisher group, and I was with Paul Cohen, but that's not my thing because I don't do it as well as I know it could be done.
You're a very modest man, my friend. Let me tell you, this is one extraordinary musician and entertainer. Maestro, we've talked for a few minutes here. We haven't heard some of your music. So of these wonderful tunes you sent us, why don't we go ahead and listen to one? You can set it up.
That's great. I love to. Well, I sent you, these are all tunes from our first album, which is called For Friends. Now, okay, this tune originally was, I was a student there at the university, and in one of my composition classes, I wrote, it was a composition that was supposed to be just using one theme, and that was it. You were supposed to do something and make something inventive, with just using the one theme. So I did, and then at the same time, my dear friend, who was kind of the patriarch of all the Caribbean music here in town, his name was Fish Ray, and Fish died, and I'd asked him to play at his funeral. So I wrote this with him in mind. It's sort of melancholy, and it's called. It was originally called "For Fish, My Friend." That's what I titled it. When Randall heard it, and we were getting ready to record, he says, "Well, this is good, but I think it needs a bridge, you know." So I said, "Okay, write it." So he wrote a bridge, and I'm so glad he did because it really elevated the piece. Well, you'll listen to it, and it's called, I just now called it Four Friends, and you'll hear the theme I did for the it's an AABA song, meaning you'll hear for the first two A's are the part that I wrote, and then Randall wrote the bridge, and by the way, produced the whole album. So we'll start with that. Is that okay, Rick? Four Friends? Thank you. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
All right, so anyway, you heard my comments about Four Friends.
So why don't you go ahead and tell us about the instrumentation while I try to...
Okay, the instrumentation is James Martin is on drums, Dennis Marks is on acoustic bass, Brian Murphy is on piano, and Randall Dallahan is on guitar, and I'm on alto saxophone. And Randall arranged everything. I don't know if you got this when I was telling you about the song. I wrote the first part, you know, as an exercise for one of my composition classes, and then Randall said, I think it needs, you know, like to be lifted in the bridge. So you'll hear the radical difference come in the bridge. And there it is. And then Randall solos. I chose not to solo on this. I just wanted to play the melody. And there you have it. We recorded this at a famous studio. I don't know if you know about Criteria and Mac Emmerman.
And oh,
Mac
sure.
Mac was our fan, and he was just very anxious to record us. So we went in the studio with Mac and the brothers there at the I can't think of the name of the studio right now, over across from Ace, where it used to be Ace Music. Anyway, we recorded. We had in the studio for about a week, and I have a couple favorite cuts that I sent you, and this is the title song for Friends, and then there's a few other originals, and then. Of the other songs are from the what we call the Great American Songbook. Jerome Kern, Frank Lesser. Oh, and the one that I really like, Professor Dallahan wrote, it's what we call a contrafax, which is a new melody written on a previously composed chord progression. And he chose the song Love is a Many Splendored Thing. I said, well, that's great. I love it. It's like a bop version of Love is a Many Splendored. You remember the song I'm talking about, right?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Yeah. So anyway, he writes a bop version of it. And I said, well, why don't we call it Love Is? You know, because we can't call it Love is a Many Splendored Thing. I say Love Is. So anyway, I got that also on the program here. If I could stop talking for about 5 minutes, we would hear some music.
Well, to take up just a moment of time, you know, I've had the pleasure of seeing you so many different times in so many different settings, from a nice little piano bar sort of setting, lots of the wonderful clubs in the Grove, and then also I've seen you in a sort of a larger performance venue. And you're always not just a wonderful musician, but you bring just a fabulous energy and warmth to your presentations. So you are what I consider more than just a wonderful musician. You're a performer in the best sense of the word. And that's just phenomenal, and I really enjoy your work. And I think just so highly of you.
Hey, Rick, do you remember we used to do the music in the park at the end of Miami Beach?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. South Point
yeah.
Park.
Yeah. Go ahead. This is my wife singing.
Thank you.
Once in a while, when there's a problem, some of the music tends to drag, and I don't want to play it if it's going to drag. Joe, let me try another cut. Let me play one of the other tunes. Maybe we can get a better sound on that one. What do you think, sir? Blue Indigo?
You want to try the Love It? You want to try the
Love It?
The one I was telling you is a contrafax of Love Is a Many Splendor Thing.
Sounds good. Let me give that one a try. And
check it out.
I've got all my pictures. Got my fingers crossed and my eyes crossed and my toes crossed, too. Excellent. Joe, tell
love
me.
Love you.
The instrumentation on that, I assume that's you on the sax?
Yeah.
Excellent, excellent. And could you tell us the other players?
Oh, sure. The composer and guitarist is Randall Dallahan, who also arranged the whole album. And then on piano is Brian Murphy. I have some issues with that particular piano that was used because it's in tune, but I always hear a little something there that is a little grates on my nerves when I should have refused, you know, the session, but, you know, there's something, sometimes you go into a session, everybody's there, well, you know, let's go on with it, you know, anyway, that's Brian on piano, and on the bass is Dennis Marks. I don't know if you remember Dennis originally from Miami, and he used to play with his father, Howard Marks, and then Dennis is now professor of music at the Tallahassee at the university there. So and then James Martin is the drummer, and I knew James from back in my Atlanta days before I moved to Houston, Texas. I was in Atlanta for many years, and that's where I first met James. And he's now performing. He's been for I guess the past 20 years at the Ritz-Carlton, right in the lounge there of the Ritz-Carlton, and over in right across the way from us, right across the trail. What is it?
Naples?
Naples. The beautiful hotel there, the Ritz-Carlton, and he plays their regular gig for them. Over 20 years they've been there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and that's it. And, of course, the vocalist that we heard a part of it is Kathleen Donato. She was singing If I Were Belle. I did bring another one that she sings. Maybe it'll sound better on this next one, or if you choose to play it. You know, you don't have to play the whole song because the album was conceived of as like, hey, let's just play. Okay, you know, play as many solos as you want, you know, and everybody know we're not going to limit, you know, the amount of time that everybody gets to solo. So the soloing is kind of long and extensive, you know. Maybe we don't have that much time. But if you just play, if you play that Long Ago and Far Away, which is a great Jerome Kern composition, and you can hear her, because she's without a doubt one of my favorite singers. And that's why I brought it, because I wanted you to hear my...
I was just going to say, a beautiful woman and performer with a lovely voice. So we'll play a few minutes of that Long Ago and Far Away.
Yeah, just ahead, you know, when you've been great.
Long ago and far away, I dreamed a dream one day, and now the dream is here beside me. Long the skies were overcast, but now the clouds have passed. You're here at last.
I've always liked Jerome Kern. Beautiful.
Oh, well, his melodies are hymn-like. I mean, they stand alone. Just hearing it, even without accompaniment or anything. He is the father. He's the father of that great American songbook, Jerome Kern.
Well, you know, you've been playing music that is, you know, from that great American songbook for so long. I was wondering if you could tell us a few of your favorite composers.
Well, I'll start with Jerome Kern, and I'll go right along and name a few of the other great men of the songbook. And Irving Berlin is
sure.
Another favorite of mine. George Gershwin, Cole Porter, Richard Rodgers, and let me see. And I would say that the favorite, you know, of that group would be Harold Arlen. And so
yeah.
These are the six composers that I most admire and are considered the fathers, the innovators of the American songbook. They're the men who, there are many composers. In fact, I teach a class now on the American songbook, and I deal with all the great composers, but these six were so innovative and so different than it had anything that had come before, you know, and those are my favorite. Well, then I love Randy Newman, you know, contemporary
yeah.
writers, and I love Tom Waits, and Greg Brown. See,
sure.
Rick, I have a wide, appreciation of music. I love all kinds of music, and I really love it. You know, just don't listen to it. I listen to it for pleasure. You know, country music. I love George Jones. I can't get enough of him. Waylon Jennings. Merle Haggard. These are my heroes. You know, and I love pop music. I love music. I haven't changed since I was a kid. You know, I dug the rhythm and blues and gospel music. I just go for it all. I just love music. See,
one of the things I've always found very interesting about your art, and I really want to compliment you on this. I was moved to commit to music. I'm hearing Gershwin. I saw the biopic about Gershwin, Rhapsody in Blue, and it just so bowled me over. I had parents like your parents where there was no arguing, there was no convincing. You basically did what they said, that was that. There was no room for debate.
Oh.
And yet somehow I managed to, at a very young age, to convince my parents to get me a trumpet, and so I began 2 years ahead of my fellows in elementary school to play trumpet. And the other pivotal thing for me was my elementary school was so fortunate. They took a class every year. They took the whole second grade to the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra in one of those lovely turn-of-the-century halls, and we would hear, you know, a full symphonic concert. And
mm-hmm.
the first time I went, it was an all Tchaikovsky show, and I was so blown away. I mean, there's just no other word for it. I was just weeping. It was so beautiful that I couldn't contain it at all. I just wept. And the principal came over to me, and she said, "Richard, what's wrong?" And I said, "The music, it's so beautiful." And she goes, "Yeah, but what's wrong?" And I said, "The music, it's so beautiful." I couldn't get past that. And so I have to admit, I was a bit of a bit of an elitist. I loved jazz, especially Dixie improvisational. I loved straight ahead, and I loved classical, and I had no room in what I thought was my personal heart for pop music. I was, like I said, a bit of an elitist. And the thing that I always admired about you was you went to a place in pop music where it was beautiful, where it was touching, where it was just inspirational. And I've always found that just very amazing about your work, that you found that beauty in pop music that I had never seen myself. I mentioned to Dan that during the late 60s when everybody was listening to the Beatles and Hendrix, I had a pickup band that did Dixieland jazz because
right.
I didn't want to play pop music. And I've always admired you, especially for that, because you can find those gems in pop music and make it as expressive, as lovely as you know, a piece of Tchaikovsky you know, some Brahms. I mean, you just find a beauty in it, and I think that's just amazing. And also, let me ask you this: as a performer, you know, you are such an effort, you make an effort to engage your audience. Were there some entertainers who you thought were masters at that? Who is it that you
absolutely?
Always
I tell you a little anecdote here that sort of expresses the, you know, or explains my heroes, my mentors. You know, when I was a student, undergraduate at the university, my film music professor is Professor Progress. He says, you know, someday I think you're going to be a big star and I would love to manage you. Well, that was a big compliment to me for the, you know, my professor wants to manage me. So, okay, so we did it. We signed up. Well, at the beginning, he asked me, he says, who do you most admire? Who do you want to be, I mean, like? I mean, where's your, you know, because I do so many different things. I said, well, let's start with Judy Garland, Al Jolson, Louis Armstrong.
Really?
Wow. Can you figure? So, you know, one of the classes that I teach asked me something about that, who were my my heroes. And I of course, I told them, you know, the story about the manager asked me, and I told them those, I think I remember those three names. I turned around, Brian Murphy was accompanying me at the class, and I said, Brian, what do you make of that? What kind of a guy? I didn't mention Charlie Parker, Cannonball Adderley, Sonny Rollins. I didn't. You know, and he says, Joe, you're an entertainer. That's what you love. Those people you mentioned, well, of course, Louis Armstrong, you know, one of the he is the founding father of jazz, at least one of them, but, you know, and the other are consummate musical artists too, but they all had that love of communicating with the audience. And to me, I think it's a matter of, well, I'll give Lenny Bruce's answer. To me, it's I'm trying to make a buck. No. I'm only kidding. Lenny, Nat Hentoff, he asked Lenny that. Lenny says, I'm trying to make a buck. No, he says, no. I want to be liked. I want the people to love me. So I give to them what I have, you know. And it moves me to do it. And then when I get it back in applause or appreciation or, Joe, we need you for the next gig. We got to have you. You know what I mean? Then I feel like I've accomplished what I set out to do. And
you know,
and
I think especially it's really amazing to me because there is so much of jazz, especially where cool. Where, you know, reticent, turning your back to the audience is a big part of what a lot of people think of jazz, where it's really not engaging the orchestra or the public. But I think, you know, it's a whole other talent to be able to be not only just a consummate musician, but also have that special art, that add-on thing, where it's not enough for you just to be a wonderful performer and lead a great ensemble and play great music, but you really work to get that audience engaged and happy and part of the performance.
Yeah.
I've seen so few people who can do that. My brother, you're a master at that as well.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Thank you. I got to tell you this this thing I heard the other day about the music, and it was on one of these talk shows, and a guy came on, and she says, well, tell me how you got started. He says, well, first I bought a guitar, then I formed a band, and then we had, you know, big hit record. Well, I said, I think they missed a part there. You know, what about did you learn music or, you know, I bought a guitar, I formed a band, and then here I am on the big TV show. Okay. So what can I tell you? You know, I'm still studying music. I practice all the time, learning new things. right now I'm in the process of going back to Charlie Parker and memorizing in 12 keys all his some of his classics.
Thank you so much for joining us, and I can't thank you enough. It is an honor to know you and call you a friend.
My pleasure, Rick. Thank you for inviting me. I've always admired you, and I hope I get to spend more time with you.
Thank you again, my brother.
In the near future.
My best to Kathleen and the kids.
Okay, thanks. Thank you, Rick.
Okay.